I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. A necessary and important book is out now called The Unexpected War, Canada in Kandahar. It illustrates how Canada became involved in the Afghanistan conflict. Its authors know of what they write. Janice Gross-Stein and Eugene Lang join me now to discuss their book. He is a former chief of staff to two ministers of national defense, and she is one of the country's foremost experts on security and foreign policy. The Unexpected War, $35 from Viking, is an insider's account featuring candid and revealing interviews from some of the key Canadians who've played a part from the aftermath of September 11th up to the present day. As the conflict continues, a look at how we got there can be had in this highly recommended book. Janice Gross-Stein is the Belzberg Professor of Conflict Management and Director of the Monk Center for International Studies at the University of Toronto. Eugene Lang is a public policy consultant and served as Chief of Staff to Defense Ministers John McCallum and Bill Graham from 2002 to 2006. He is a visiting fellow at the same Monk Center at the University of Toronto. Eugene Lang is on the line from Ottawa this morning while Janice Gross-Stein joins us from Toronto. Welcome both to the Plant on the Line program.
Good morning.
Thanks for both for joining us. Eugene, I'll begin with you. How did the two of you come together to write this book?
Oh, well, we met one another 4 or 5 years ago when I was in the Defense Department, and Janice was at the U of T, and we obviously have had common interests in a lot of these issues and developed a relationship and a friendship around some of these issues. And then after I left government, we talked about doing something on this issue of Canada's ongoing role in Afghanistan, which we both agreed was quite fundamental, and we didn't feel that there was sufficient debate out there in the public domain or sufficient dialogue or knowledge about what we'd done in the past, and felt that it was important to try and write something to inform the debate in some small way.
Janice, I was interested in reading your book because, you know, I know of the Afghanistan conflict simply from what I read in the papers. I don't know much of the background. This filled me in on a lot of things that went on behind the scenes. What people seem to think that this is one big war that happened after September 11th. In the book, you illustrate that it's probably about three conflicts, correct?
Yes, it's certainly more. First of all, it didn't happen after September 11th, only Afghanistan. It has really been at war in the modern period for 30 years, since the Soviets invaded Afghanistan in 1979. It's almost been an unending period of war. Secondly, if you look at the modern period, the period Jean and I are writing about in the book, you have the United States coming first to oust the Taliban government, but principally really focused on Al-Qaeda and capturing members of Al-Qaeda who planned and initiated the attacks of September the 11th. You have, secondly, a conflict within Afghanistan itself. Taliban, who are part of Afghanistan, are part of the Pashtun community, but who reject the consensus that came out of the process which created the Karzai government. And thirdly, you have that overlain with large elements of the Pashtun community who live on the other side of a border, a border which Pakistan recognizes but Afghanistan never has. And in fact, the majority of Pashtuns live in Pakistan, not in Afghanistan.
The Genesis JTF-2 mission that Canadian forces were doing. They were doing that that you write about in the book. They were doing that with the Americans, were they? And,
yes.
And roughly when was this?
Well, the JTF-2, these are our special forces, Canada's special forces, which are frankly some of the best in the world. They went to Afghanistan very early on. You know, the government never announced a date on which they were deployed, but certainly acknowledged by late November that there were Canadian Special Forces operating alongside their American counterparts in Afghanistan, and they are still there today.
Eugene, around the time that this all began, I guess this was after September 11th or thereabouts, was Afghanistan a priority on the government's the Canadian government's list?
No, I don't think that Afghanistan was a priority on many Western governments' lists. It was not something that many countries have been thinking about prior to 9/11. it had been a pretty isolated society during the 90s when the Taliban was ruling. There was very little media reporting on what was going on in Afghanistan because there were very few Western journalists in the country. I don't think there were any Canadian journalists in the country until after 9/11, and it wasn't a focal point of Canadian foreign policy, but it suddenly became, well, not suddenly, it suddenly got on the radar screen after 9/11 and became an increasing focal point of Canadian foreign and defense policy since that point in time.
The one thing, Eugene, that I get struck by reading your book is the fact that we seem to have gone in, Canada has, not knowing much about the country of Afghanistan. Why didn't we know very much, and is there anyone we should blame?
No, I mean, we didn't know very much, as I say, because it wasn't a country that we were thinking much about or focusing much on in the 90s. And as I say, I don't think very many countries were. We hadn't had an embassy in Afghanistan, I think, for nearly 30 years until around 2000. Well, it was in 2003 when we established one. So we did not know very much about Afghanistan. We didn't have great expertise in the foreign ministry on Afghanistan. We had no expertise in the Canadian forces on that country until we went in 2001, 2002. And I don't think we had much expertise even after we had been there a couple of years. I mean, gradually we've built up our knowledge of that country and built up expertise since the Canadian forces have been there now for pretty consistently for about 5 years, 5 or 6 years.
Janice, is this notion that Canada's military has evolved from a peacekeeping role to a full combat role because of Afghanistan, is that a correct notion that we should be making?
I think, in fact, Canada's military, to just go back a little bit in time, Canada's military in the 20th century was a combat military. We're approaching November the 11th, and in fact, of course, Canadian forces fought in World War I and World War II. So our tradition as a combat military goes very long and very deep in our country's history. We had a period of peacekeeping in the 50s, 60s, 70s, but really Canada's military has evolved because the world has evolved. The kind of classic peacekeeping mission which we did, where we interposed ourselves between the armies of two separate states and vacant territory, that kind of mission no longer exists in the world. And Afghanistan, we argue in the book, is in fact a taste of the future. Civil wars, insurgencies. This is in fact, as General Hillier argues, the kind of challenge Canada is likely to face in the future. Mm-hmm. And the peacekeeping model doesn't fit that model.
Canada's role in the world and its image has been shaped by this war already. Do you think in the future that Canada's role around the world in different conflicts will reflect much the same in Afghanistan, Janice?
I certainly think the challenges posed by Afghanistan will continue. When we speak to Canadians, many Canadians who don't support this particular mission, and we say to them, well, would you support a Canadian contribution to the UN peacekeeping force that is going into Darfur? And you get a universal yes. In fact, the conditions in Darfur are as challenging, if not more challenging, than in Afghanistan. There is still ongoing intense fighting among rebel militias themselves. There's no infrastructure on the ground. It's been destroyed by the Janjaweed forces. And there's no question that peacekeeping force, so-called peacekeeping force, will take casualties and will engage in combat.
It already has taken casualties.
It already
the
has.
The African Union force that's been there for the last couple of years has already taken casualties, fatalities.
Eugene, this agreement that Canada signed, I guess, regarding detainees, mm-hmm. That was between, General Hillier signed that on behalf of the government, the Department of National Defense, correct?
Yes.
And this made a lot of news earlier this year because it seemed to a lot of people that you were in government. Should the Department of Defense have signed that rather than Foreign Affairs, or...?
I think in hindsight, the foreign ministry should have had a much stronger role in hand in negotiating that agreement and with the government of Afghanistan. They were consulted on it, but I don't think they played the kind of leadership role on that sort of state-to-state agreement that you would normally expect. And probably the agreement suffered as the agreement that was signed by the Martin government suffered as a result. Now that agreement has since been superseded by a new agreement that the Harper government negotiated in the spring with the government of Afghanistan. I think Foreign Affairs was probably more centrally involved in that one. And from my understanding of that agreement is it's one of the most stringent of any NATO state in terms of the protections it affords detainees that are transferred to Afghan authorities.
This whole
just on that point,
sure.
It's interesting that really no NATO country can fully protect detainees, even with the tightest possible agreement.
Right. Yeah.
And it can't because conditions in Afghan prisons don't meet the standards of most NATO countries. The availability of monitors to go into those prisons is not good enough. This is an interesting case. NATO has no uniform policy, which all members subscribe to. It's done on a nation-by-nation bilateral negotiation with Afghanistan. There should be, in fact, a NATO policy, and I would argue there should be a NATO detention facility.
Yeah, absolutely.
Gene, I was interested in terms of what happened with this agreement and regarding detainees. Was that indicative, do you think, of the relationship between defense and foreign affairs?
Well, there's no doubt there's some rivalries and tensions there, or certainly there was when I was in government between those two departments. And that probably played a role in this. I think inside the Defense Department at the time, the view was, you know, this is going to be a very challenging mission for the Canadian Forces. This mission is the Canadian Forces mission. Foreign Affairs will be peripherally involved, and therefore the Canadian Forces and the Department of Defense is going to take the lead on negotiating this important transfer agreement.
Janice, the notion that the war in Afghanistan is like Iraq, is that apt?
No. And we say that very clearly in the book. Afghanistan is not Iraq, and it's not Iraq from two perspectives. First, of course, the attack against the Taliban was authorized by the United Nations. Secondly, NATO invoked Article 5, that is a provision in the NATO Charter, which obliges member states to come to the defense of a fellow member state who is attacked. So this is the kind of multilateral mission which Canadians traditionally have supported. Secondly, Afghanistan is not Iraq because if you look at the polling data of Afghans, and with all the caveats about the difficulties, nevertheless, there is overwhelming opposition among Afghans, even in the south, to the return of the Taliban. That is something that Afghans clearly do not want to see happen. So I think it's a very bad mistake to equate the two of them. Some of the challenges in terms of fighting insurgencies are similar, but that's really where the analogy stops.
Gene, the American government, the Bush administration, what were they expecting of Canada with regards to the Iraq conflict? Because this had happened, the mounting of the Iraq operation was around this time that you were in government, correct?
Yeah, we have a chapter that deals with this issue in the book. Certainly the Bush administration at the political level, as people like Donald Rumsfeld, the President, Colin Powell, and others fully expected and desired Canada's political support for the American intervention in Iraq, whether or not it was authorized by the United Nations. But it was made clear to the then Defense Minister, John McCallum, who I worked for. We had a meeting with Rumsfeld within about 6 or 7 weeks of the outbreak of the Iraq War, where Rumsfeld made it clear that he was not expecting or necessarily desiring an army, infantry, or ground force contribution from Canada to the invasion of Iraq. Rumsfeld made it clear that he wanted, or he preferred that Canada concentrate its efforts in Afghanistan, and in particular in leading the ISAF mission in Kabul, which at that time was confined to Kabul.
Why has the story then sort of run away from that, and it's sort of this sort of political stuff that you see between the United States and America with regards to Iraq and sort of not supporting allies? Why has that come out, do you think?
I think generally because the debate got muddied by the press. in the run-up to the Iraq War, the issue that was debated in the press, if you go back and look at some of the columns that were being written at the time, the question was, were we going to war with the United States? That was never the issue, as we show in the book. The issue really was, would we support the war that the United States was about to engage in? And here, Prime Minister Chretien was adamant. His instincts were really visceral on this. He was not going to support that war. But that's different from the debate that most people think we had, which was, would we go to war with the United States?
And if you look back at that, you may recall that it was referred to by Washington as the Coalition of the Willing. And that coalition, I think, comprised something like 30 countries at one point. And very few of those countries actually had ground forces in Iraq. But they were politically supporting the American effort, and they may have been providing other token military contributions, naval contributions, air contributions, this sort of thing. But there weren't, I think there were many countries on that so-called coalition of the willing list that had virtually no troops in Iraq.
The relationship between the United States seems to be at the fore of this conflict. You write that, both of you, in the book. Was Canada bullied to go into Afghanistan by the Bush administration?
No, not at all. I mean, initially, right after 9/11, it was quite the contrary. Canada was fairly desperate to get involved in some way in Afghanistan after 9/11. We chronicle this in the book, and we've interviewed former U.S. Ambassador Salucci, who talks about this in some detail. The second mission, which was the ISAF mission in Kabul that Canada took over in the summer of 2003, the government of Canada had been considering a role in that mission for some time. Rumsfeld made it clear that he preferred Canada to lead the mission. We considered that, and in the end agreed to do that. We weren't bullied into doing it by any means, but it was certainly the fact that the Americans wanted Canada in Kabul was certainly a factor in the decision making. And similarly with this third mission in Kandahar, fundamentally the impetus for that mission came right from the government of Canada. But again, there was a view at the time that this kind of a contribution of this scale would certainly be appreciated by the Americans and by NATO and by the British and by other countries.
Janice, do officials in Afghanistan, people in Afghanistan, have a sense of how this conflict dominates Canadian politics?
I think it's hard sometimes, actually, for people to understand, if they're not in the country, how important this is in Canadian politics and to many, many Canadians. Certainly President Karzai is very well aware of, first of all, how important Canada is to him. He recognizes that. That's why he's visited Canada. And Afghan officials regularly visit Canada. But I think it's difficult. The cultural gap is large for others to understand. It's quite interesting, actually. We had a very senior American defense expert come to Canada last week, and he spent 2 days here. The subject was, of course, Afghanistan. And he said to me at the end of the visit, he had not realized, even he coming from Washington, how important this issue is in Canadian politics. He had underestimated the political significance of Afghanistan and Canada right now.
Gene, the Prime Minister, former Prime Minister Chretien, has written in his book that he's implying here that Paul Martin's dithering led to troops being sent to Kandahar, thus a lot of them being killed. How do you respond to the Chretien's assertion?
There was a lengthy debate that went on between the Defense Department and the Foreign Ministry in Ottawa at the officials level over the issue of what part of Afghanistan Canada would deploy this so-called Provincial Reconstruction Team, which is a commitment that the government of Canada had made at the end of 2003, that after we ended our term in Kabul, we would deploy a PRT, Provincial Reconstruction Team, somewhere in Afghanistan. There's a lengthy debate among officials as to what would be the appropriate location, geographic location in the country for that. And that started under the Chretien government and continued through the first year of the Martin administration. And then when General Hillier was appointed CDS, he made a recommendation within days or a couple of weeks at most of his appointment to Bill Graham, the defense minister, who in turn made a recommendation to Mr. Martin as to the location of this PRT and other force configurations. There was a discussion among ministers with the prime minister. It eventually went to cabinet, and a decision was made in about 2 months after the recommendation went forward. So that's the chronology of facts, which we lay out in some painstaking detail in the book. People can interpret it, I guess, as how they like.
The notion, though, Gene, that it is Harper's war is wrong.
Well, in a sense, Mr. Harper and his government have embraced this conflict and this mission in a way that the previous government hadn't, and has extended the mission and has signaled that he would like to extend the mission beyond the February 2009 date. And I think from a political standpoint, it's become one of the defining features of the Harper government, which is somewhat ironic because the mission was designed and the decision to deploy into this region was made by the previous government, by the Martin government. But actually the full force configuration on the ground didn't really get into Kandahar until the Harper government came to office. And none of the casualties really occurred until after the Harper government was in office in the spring of 2006.
They were stunned. I mean, they were in office essentially
weeks.
For a month. Yeah, for
yeah,
a matter
yeah.
of weeks, less than a month, when the first really, really serious fighting began.
I think really the way to describe it is the Harper government inherited the mission
yeah.
and has embraced it as its own.
Janice, what do you think the Prime Minister's task force will accomplish, if anything?
Well, it's a really interesting innovation, certainly. We've never before in Canada had a commission appointed by a prime minister which has a very senior former civil servants, which has a respected member of the Liberal Party to make recommendations to the country and to his government on what should be done during a time of war. So it's unprecedented in our modern history. It's unprecedented in our history at all. I think the commission will take a broad look. They have a very, very short timeline. 3 months. They will be visiting Afghanistan. They will be going to Brussels. They will be going to Washington. They will be going to New York to talk to the Secretary General. And then they will have to make a recommendation about what makes sense for Canada. Clearly, by their travel itinerary, they are considering Canada's responsibilities to NATO. They will be taking a look on the ground at what's happening in Afghanistan. And they will be looking to make a recommendation, hopefully not only one for the next 2 years, because one of the things that Gene and I argue very strongly in the book is that thinking about Afghanistan in one-year slices is not the way forward.
Hey, and you've both traveled to Afghanistan, have you?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm wondering, because in the first chapter it does a wonderful job in sort of laying the groundwork, I guess it's the second chapter, on the where Afghanistan's been, just the disarray, the chaos of it all.
Right.
Do you think, I mean, what's the goal here? Are we reconstructing a country, or what sort of country are we...
The best way to describe the kind of challenge that Canada faces. People talk about, can we win this war? Can we defeat the Taliban? I don't think that's the right question. The real question is, can we contain the Taliban long enough so that an Afghan national army can be built up from scratch? It's not reconstructing the army, it's constructing the army. An even bigger challenge is the police force. Is there enough time? Can we contain the Taliban long enough so that there can be some economic development, some of the devastated infrastructure can be rebuilt? And we ask the question that way, I think we get a sense of the time frame that would be involved.
Gene, do you think that, I mean, when we hear people say, how are we going to win this war, what do you see as the goal?
Well, the goal for, I mean, let's keep in mind this is not Canada's project. This is NATO's project, and Canada's a part of NATO. This is a project of a 26-member alliance that's taken on this task, and it's a long-term task of basically rebuilding a war-torn country. I've been there three times over the last 5 or 6 years, and I've seen some evolution in the improvement of the situation, at least in the capital city. I didn't see great improvement in the south. But we're talking about a country that has infrastructure virtually wiped out during the Civil War. So you've got to rebuild a physical infrastructure. It doesn't really have a functioning economy by Western standards. It's essentially a narco-economy. So you've got to try and find creative ways to diversify out of poppy and develop a legitimate economy. That's not going to happen overnight. And as Janice says, you have to build up institutions of governance in the country, everything from security institutions, judiciary, public service, right across the spectrum. Western countries can assist with that to a degree. A lot of that has to come from Afghans themselves, all the while that you're dealing with an insurgency that's particularly ferocious in the south, but there are signs that it's growing in other regions of the country. So it's a very complex, multifaceted task. By the way, NATO has never done anything like this before. Canada has never done anything like this before. This is a new ground for everyone, and it's going to take time and patience and a lot of resources. But hopefully, when you're 10 or 15 years down the road, you can look back at a country that's progressed significantly and is much more stable and is much more, looks a lot more like a democracy with functioning state institutions. That's part of that's not a source of instability in that region, but becomes more of a source of stability.
Janice, the sense that you get traveling the country, do they feel that they need Canada there, they want Canada there, and the whole NATO?
It's one of the most striking things. There is, even in the South, the recognition that Canadian forces are playing an important role, absolute fear and panic among people at the thought of Canada withdrawing, an understanding, the wish that Canadian forces stay, as people put it, until the job is done. People remember very vividly those years from 96 to 2001. What we in the rest of the world remember is we remember the attacks of 9/11, the destruction of the Buddhas in Bamiyan province. What Afghans remember, especially Afghan women, is being forced into their homes, being unable to go to work, having their lives completely disrupted for 5 years. So I can honestly say that there is both great appreciation and real concern at the thought that Canada might not renew this mission inside Afghanistan.
One of the reviewers of the book singled you out and criticizing the book, called it a partisan whitewash. How do you respond to that?
I don't think he's read the book. Most of the people that have read the book haven't drawn anywhere near that kind of conclusion. We've tried to just lay out the facts as we understand them based on a combination of my experience in government for about 4 years around this issue, research we've done of public sources, and a vast number of interviews we've done with people in government today, people that were in government before, on and off the record, senior military officials in Canada and from the United States and other NATO countries. So we've done our research and we've tried to lay out a chronology of the facts, and I think there are very few, if you read the book, you'll find very few moral judgments in the book from us, so I don't accept the criticism at all.
Just to add to what Jean said, if you look at the range of reviews that have come out in the last 2 weeks, I think the thrust, the overwhelming thrust of these reviews is, oh my goodness, we've learned a lot about how our own government, and that includes the Chrétien government, the Martin government, and the Harper government, make decisions. This is a spotlight really shining in an area which Canadians don't know much about. And Gina and I didn't write this book for anybody but the Canadian public, frankly.
And I would also say that the book covers decision-making from three different governments, two Liberal governments and one Conservative government, And I think if you read those chapters, you'll find that in all cases, we're showing a lot of warts on all those governments. So the idea that this is some sort of liberal revisionist history or whitewash, I find, frankly, absurd.
It is a necessary and important book, and I want to thank you for coming on today, both of you, and congratulate you on the book. Janice, thanks so much for joining us, and Eugene, thanks for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure.
It's been great, thank you.
The book is called The Unexpected War, Canada in Kandahar, $35 from Viking. I'm Joseph Ponto.